The Shorter Oxford Dictionary describes the gramophone as an instrument for recording and reproducing vocal, instrumental, and other sounds. A succinct summation of something that's given us so much pleasure for so many years. It's certainly gone through many changes, passing from cylinders to the sophisticated machines of today. The English company EMI has been in the business since 1898, recording many of the world's greatest artists through the years. Tonight we bring you a varied selection that covers the first 34 years of recorded entertainment from that company. Alastair Cook is the narrator.
What you've just heard was recorded on the 2nd of September, 1898, by a hotel orchestra. Until that time, nobody had ever heard a hotel orchestra outside the hotel itself. But then came the magic of the talking machine, an American invention which the English called the gramophone. And in that year, in London's Maiden Lane, just off the Strand, a small company was started called, naturally, the Gramophone Company. It had just acquired the British and European rights to a new kind of talking machine, which, instead of the usual wax cylinders, played flat shellac discs on a turntable. In the first flush of marketing a total novelty, the company took the risk of daring to record an orchestra for its first release. It's the Hotel Cecil Orchestra playing a brand new song, Funiculi Funicula. Today, we may wince at the scratch they marveled at the reproduction of an invisible orchestra. This was only a month away from the first sound that the company had recorded. Fred Geisberg, an American brought over to run the recording program, was so eager to show off the wonders of the new process that he went no farther than a restaurant next door. It was Rule's restaurant, which had a singing barmaid. Well, she had at least a powerful voice, which then seemed essential to pierce through the hurricane of surface noise. Syria Lamont was her name, and she sang into a horn and became the company's first recording artist with Coming Through the Rye. The company was convinced that to the ears of the Victorians, the gramophone was going to be the eighth wonder of the world. And within 3 months, it had the confidence to sign up a musical comedy star famous both in London and Paris, a Frenchman, Maurice Farquhar. His specialty was a laughing song, Le Fou Rire, much talked about by sophisticates. But now anybody could hear him without the bother of crossing the channel. À l'enterrement de sa belle-mère, pour être folle de combien, dans une tenue très sévère, j'arrivais de l'air sans moyen. Mais après la cérémonie, quand on a dû serrer la main, voyant sa face épanouie, la mourir qui va prendre soudain. Adieu, adieu. Ah, The simple fact that the world is full of sounds made the company as playful as a family Christmas party in wanting to have everybody do his little turn, musical or not. One of the company's family was Trevor Williams, celebrated in his domestic circle for his farmyard imitations. So, since he was the company chairman, he got into the act with some lively caterwauling he called Morning on the Farm.
A morning on the farm.
November 1900, 2 years after the company's founding, the Savoy Theatre was putting on the first revival of Gilbert and Sullivan's Patience. On the opening night, W.S. Gilbert and Rupert Doyley Cart took the last curtain call they would take together. Sir Arthur Sullivan was not there. In his house on Victoria Street, he was, in fact, on his deathbed. The company decided that the passing of this wonderful collaboration should be commemorated, and they persuaded Walter Passmore, the star of Patience, to record Bunthorne's song, If You're Anxious for to Shine.
Bunthorne's song from Patience by Gilbert and Sullivan.
If you're anxious for to shine in the high aesthetic line as a man of culture, you must get up all the germs of the trank and gentle terms and plant them everywhere. You must lie upon the daisies and distort in novel phrases of your complicated state of mind. The meaning doesn't matter if it's only idle chatter of a transcendental kind. And everyone will say, as you walk your mystic way, if this young man expresses himself in terms too deep for me, why, what a very singularly deep young man this deep young man must be. Be eloquent in praise of those very dull old days that have long since passed away, and convince them if you can that the reign of good Queen Anne was cultural from yesterday. Of course you will pooh-pooh whatever's threatened and new and declare it crude and mean, far out, stop short in the cultivated court of the Empress Josephine. And everyone will say, as you walk your mystic way, if that's not good enough for him, which is good enough for me, why, what a very cultivated kind of youth this kind of youth must be.
There was another weird and wonderful sound in the 1890s that had just burst through the gentility of the concert halls. It came from America, and it was called ragtime, which some sharp musician described as white music played black. One of its first ambassadors was a banjoist named Wes Ossman. And on a spring day in 1900, he sat down and recorded something called Smoky Mokes. If that old recording horn had been just a little more sensitive, it would have picked up a tidal wave of cheers rolling down the Strand. For it was the day that the news came in of the relief of Mafeking, May 18th, 1900.
Thank you.
the willingness of a doily cart star and other famous entertainers to sing into the horn gave Fred Geisberg a breathtaking idea. Why not go after the world's opera stars? He went off to Milan with what, by the standards of the day, was greatly improved recording equipment. Geisberg was at La Scala for the first night of a now-forgotten opera by Alberto Franchetti called Germania. He was excited by the tenor. He hustled around to the dressing room and signed up the young man to make 10 records for the impressive flat fee of £100. They rigged up the equipment in a private drawing room of the Grand Hotel on the 11th of April, 1902. And this is the first disc they cut, a solo from Germania. Recording might still be primitive, but there was nothing wrong with Geisberg's hearing. The young tenor's name was Enrico Caruso. Now you'd better steel yourself for a very peculiar sound. What you hear there in the background is the voice of a 46-year-old man, a male soprano, Alessandro Moreschi. He was the director of the Sistine Choir at the Vatican and one of the last of the so-called castrati. These musical oddities were surgically adjusted males who flourished from the Renaissance until the early 19th century. Desmond Shaw Taylor, in a well-modulated understatement, characterizes Moreschi's voice as surprising, but never exquisite. After the company had been going about 7 years, it guessed, correctly, that very few musical artists in the world would willingly reject the gramophone's tempting offer of immortality. So they got to the greatest diva of her time, perhaps of any time, Adelina Patti, who made her debut in 1859 and was still on a round of farewell recitals 50 years later. In the winter of 1905, she was 62, and in her mammoth Victorian castle in Wales, she recorded a Spanish song, La Calicera. The record, by the way, was withdrawn 2 weeks after it came out because her high notes blasted the needle out of the groove. Well, we've managed to keep it in, and it's probably the best of all her recordings. By now, they'd had to admit that orchestral music somehow didn't come out as well as solos, but there were encouraging exceptions like this one. Artur Nikisz and the London Symphony Orchestra enlists Hungarian Rhapsody. At the recording session, one of the players remarked that another conductor, Hans Richter, seemed to favor a different tempo. That, said Nikisz, is because he is a German-Hungarian. I am a Hungarian-Hungarian. Summer of 1914, the Archduke Ferdinand of Austria was murdered at Sarajevo, and it seemed for a while that the music, as well as the lights, would go out all over Europe. After only 1 year, the opposing armies were bogged down in a long arc of trenches that severed most of France. They fought for 3 years over the possession of a few miles of land in between, and they died, as many as 50,000 a night. And reinforcements moved up and died. But at a time when there was no nightly television report of the morning's slaughter, when to the people at home the war was a large, vague horror, out there, young men, younger and younger men, put on uniform, accepted it as a duty to fight for king and country, and marched off to no man's land singing a song which to anybody who lived through that war will be always the bravest, the most forlorn of war songs.
Pack up your troubles in your old kit bag and smile, smile, smile. While you balloon that was to light your fag, smile, boys, that's the style. What's the use of worrying? It never was worthwhile. Pack up your troubles in your old kit bag and smile, smile, smile.
6,000 miles from the trenches in Hollywood, California, there lived a very famous Englishman, Charlie Chaplin. There was a war song about him, with new words written for an American tune called Red Wing. It was a facetious song that proposed to mend Charlie's baggy trousers and generally tidy him up before we send him to the Dardanelles. When Chaplin heard the song with the new words, he said, "It scared the daylights out of me. I thought they were really coming to get me."
Someday there will come the time to wind up the watch on the Rhine, and Tommy and Jack will come marching back and take a cup for the sake of auld lang syne. But ere the happy day, the Germans have got to pay. When we march in to capture Berlin, we'll sing them this little lay. When the moon shines bright on Charlie Chaplin, his boots are cracking for want of blacking, and his little baggy trousers they want mending before we send him to the Dardanelles. When the moon shines bright on Charlie Chaplin, his boots are cracking for want of blacking, and his little baggy trousers they want mending before we send him to the Dardanelles.
To the troops on leave, there was one voice more than any other that seemed to banish the nightmare of the war with reminders of the good and the naughty things of life, which, if they were lucky, they might enjoy again. She was Mary Lloyd, the best-loved artist of the London music halls.
I never was the one to go and stint myself. If I liked a thing, I liked it, and that's enough. But there's lots of people say that if you like a thing a lot, it'll grow on you and all that sort of stuff. Now, I like me drop a start as well as anyone. But start, you know, supposed to make you fat. Oh, and if any lardy-dardy madam wouldn't dare to touch it, because it might spoil her figure the finish yet. Now, I always have in it, if you fancy it. If you fancy it, that's understood. And suppose it makes you fat, I don't worry over that. Cause a little of what you fancy does you good.
One of the two or three great wartime successes in London, what we should call an escapist musical, was a revue, The Bing Boys Are Here. It opened at the Alhambra in April 1916. Here are its stars, George Robey and Violet Lorraine, with its hit song.
If you were the only girl in the world, and you nothing else would matter in this world today. We could go on from loving in the same old way.
A Garden of Eden, just made for two, with nothing to mar our joy.
I could say such wonderful things to you.
Finally ended, and in France it was sent off with a rousing peroration in the Marche Militaire Française. And in the company's Paris studio, it was played for the gramophone by an 84-year-old of enviable gusto, the composer himself, Camille Saint-Saëns. Startling sound that heralded the 1920s. I don't suppose there's ever been a group of performers that so revolutionized the course of popular music as the so-called original Dixieland Jazz Band. Of course, they didn't originate jazz. Its origins go back obscurely into Negro work song and the Cotton Kingdom. But this group distilled the raw material into band music that captivated first New York in 1917 and 2 years later, London, which is where they cut this sizzling version of Tiger Rag. For nearly 30 years since the recording of that Barmaid, every recording artist played or sang or talked into a horn and sound box. In the mid-20s, there was an historic leap forward into electrical recording with microphones and electrical amplifiers. It had two effects. Everything sounded more lifelike, and in popular music, orchestrators came along to arrange and tailor jazz into an ambitious sound known as symphonic jazz. Following on the example of Paul Whiteman in America, nobody in England did better at exploiting the resources of the new sound than Jack Hilton. The '20s, we've come to see, were the golden age of American show tune composers. Jerome Kern, Irving Berlin, Richard Rodgers, Vincent Humans, Henderson, George Gershwin. Gershwin's Lady Be Good opened in London in April 1926 and featured the incomparable brother-sister team of Fred and Adele Astaire. Early in the run, they recorded a few of the show's songs with Gershwin himself at the piano. This one is called The Half of It, Dearie, Blues. It's still unique for its intimacy and the offhand ad-libbing between George Gershwin and Fred Astaire. Thank you. many Europeans, American jazz was a wild and disturbing sound. It was acceptably tamed for them by two Americans, Turner Layton and Clarence Johnston, who settled in England in the early 20s.
Bluebird, bluebird, calling me far away, I've been longing for you. Bluebird, bluebird, this is my lucky day, skies are turning to blue. I'm like a flower that's fading here, where every hour is one long tear. Bluebird, bluebird, this is my lucky day, none of my dreams will come true. Back home, my cabin wall, here I go, singing low. Why, my blackbird, where somebody waits for me, sugar sweet, so is she. Why, my blackbird, no one here can love or understand me. Oh, what hard luck stolen people and me. Make my bed like the light, I'll arrive late tonight. Blackbird, bye-bye.
Many writers have tried to pin down the universal appeal of jazz in the first era of technology. For me, William Empson has said it all in one phrase: the hypnotized abandonment of self to the exact rhythms of machinery. Well, the drive of the genuine article, wild or not, still came from America. And there was a great band, at one time aptly called the Jungle Band, which made no concessions to genteel tastes and has remained for over 45 years the supreme jazz orchestra. It's that of Duke Ellington, who made Merry-Go-Round for the English market in 1933. In the 20s also, the recording companies refined and expanded the range of the microphone so that it was now possible to record directly in the concert hall or opera house. They did this at Covent Garden in June 1926 at the farewell performance of a legendary soprano who had made her debut there 38 years before. This sentimental parting filled her idolaters with understandable anxiety. At 67, no voice retains the glory of its prime. But to everyone's astonishment, Dame Nellie Melba released the same floating tones and effortless legato that had made her the golden girl of the golden age of opera. ¶¶ By now, the gramophone company had a regular mobile recording van, and in 1927, it pulled up outside Temple Church in London to record the extraordinary voice of Master Ernest Luff, a 15-year-old, in Mendelssohn's Hear My Prayer. This, incidentally, was the first of the company's records to sell over 1 million copies. When radio broadcasting came in, it was confidently predicted that the record companies would go out of business. On the contrary, one appetite fed the other. Electrical recording could now embalm for keeps sounds and talents as far apart as the piping boy soprano of Master Luff and the elemental outpourings of the greatest basso of his day, Fyodor Shalyapin. By 1929, the silent screen had started to talk and sing. One of Paramount's hits that year was a musical called Innocents of Paris, in which Maurice Chevalier sang a song he thought was
wonderful, oh, it's wonderful to be in love with you. Beautiful, you're so beautiful, you haunt me all day through. Every little breeze seems to whisper Louise, birds in the trees seem to twitter Louise. Each little rose tells me it knows I love you, love you. Every little beat that I feel in my heart seems to repeat what I felt at the start. Each little sigh tells me that I adore you, Louise. Just to see and hear you is joy I never knew. But to be so near you thrills me through and through. Anyone can see why I wanted your kiss. It had to be, but the wonder is this. Can it be true someone like you could love me, Louise?
If Chevalier was the mythical soul of Paris, Tauber was Vienna Incorporated.
Leise, ganz leise, klingt der Traum, liebliche Weise bald ertraut. Dieses Erschmerzen zärtlicher Chor ringt aus dem Herzen selig empor. Ringt erlangen Glück und Ruh, Hoffen und Bangen, Liebe bist du. Einmal noch leben, ehe vorbei. Einmal noch leben, lieben im Mai. Einmal noch beben, ehe vorbei. Einmal noch lieben, lieben im Mai.
And if you'd asked any Briton to sum up Lancashire in two words, there would have been no contest. The answer was a girl from a mill town with no claim to vocal purity or power, only a brassy and beguiling honesty. Gracie Fields.
Sally, Sally, don't ever wander away from the alley. Sally, Sally, marry me, Sally, and happy forever I'll be. When skies are blue, you'll be beguiling, and when they're gray, you're still smiling, smiling. Sally, Sally, bride of our alley, you're more than the whole world to me.
It seems such a shame when the English claim the earth that they give rise to such hilarity and mirth. Those jocular lines were written by an Englishman for a chuckling English audience because the Empire, everybody knew, was as immune to jokes as to the setting sun. But the sun did set, and now Noel Coward's satirical Mad Dogs and Englishmen is a riotous, even nostalgic period piece.
It's such a surprise to the eastern eyes to see that though the English are effete, they're quite impervious to heat. When the white man rides, every native hides in glee, because the simple creatures hope he will impale his solar topi on the tree. It seems such a shame when the English claim the earth, that they give rise to such hilarity and mirth. Mad dogs and Englishmen go out in the midday sun. The toughest Burmese bandit can never understand it. In Rangoon, the heat of noon is just what the natives shun. They put the Scotch or rye down and lie down. In a jungle town where the sun beats down to the rage of man and beast, the English garb of the English Saab merely gets a bit more creased. In Bangkok, at 12 o'clock, they foam at the mouth and run. But mad dogs and Englishmen go out in the midday sun. Mad dogs and Englishmen go out in the midday sun. The smallest Malay rabbit deplores this foolish habit. In Hong Kong, they strike a gong and fire off a noonday gun to reprimand each inmate who's in late. In the mangrove swamps where the python romps, there is peace from 12 to 2. Even caribous lie around and snooze, there's nothing else to do. In Bengal, to move at all is seldom, if ever, done. But mad dogs and Englishmen go out in the midday, 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 out in the midday sun.
One of the gramophone company's proudest achievements was to have recorded all the major orchestral works of Britain's greatest living composer under his own direction. In 1932, 2 years before his death, Sir Edward Elgar, conducted his violin concerto for a child prodigy from San Francisco who had then reached the ripe age of 16. His name, of course, was Yehudi Menuhin.
Alastair Cook was the narrator in that survey of the first 34 years of recorded entertainment from the English recording company EMI, which has been in the business since 1898. And I guess that's what we have time for in this week's Sentimental Journey. Don't forget we'll be tracing the songs from the Broadway and London musicals of the 1950s in next week's program, as well as presenting some rare recordings of Artie Shaw, Jimmy Dorsey, and Mildred Bailey.